Jaybeam and Jay Savitri, everyone. I'm Tenmori Soundarajan, and this is Cast in the United States with First Post. Today's episode is part of our continuing exploration of cast and tech. Joining us is Raghav, who has worked at Microsoft and the larger tech industry for over 15 years. Raghav is going to give us a tech confidential about what cast hegemonies really are like in the tech sector, and also some of the things we can do to get ourselves out of this problem. Jaybeam, and welcome, Raghav.
Jaybeam, Tenmori.
So Raghav, you have been a tech professional for many years. Can you tell our audience how real is this casteism?
So in order to understand the casteism, so the short answer is it's quite prevalent. But I think in order to really appreciate the extent of casteism which is there in the tech sector, it's important to start earlier, right? So the tech sector in the US does have a lot of Indians as in their employees. And it's important to understand where these Indians come from. Many of them are immigrants from India, and they are products of the education system, in particular the higher education system. So before we get to like answering your question in detail, let's look at the source. So, you know, there is a long history, I don't have to tell you, but there is a long history of caste discrimination in education, right? I guess the main symbol of that you can say is when you read Annihilation of Caste by Ambedkar, you will see this quote. The Manusmriti says something like, if the Dalits or the Shudras read the Vedas, their tongues will be cut off. And if they listen to the Vedas, then molten lead will be poured into their ears. So that sort of encapsulates the attitude towards education and the importance of education actually on both sides, because both the Dalit Bahujan community as well as the Savarna community understood that education is the key to dignity. Education is the key to a good life in many ways. And so it was important to, it was a very important flashpoint in history. And that shows up in today's educational system. So if you look at the higher educational system, which is like the immediate source of all these employees in the tech sector, you will see a variety of casteist attitudes playing out. So let's take like a few examples, right? One particular example we could take is the attitudes towards affirmative action. You know, I guess the best illustration of that is generally the higher educational institutions are pretty apolitical, right? People are just talking about their technical work. But for example, in 2006, there were announcement of reservations for the other backward castes. These supposedly apolitical students of these higher education institutions got organized, right? They got organized to fight against it. They even started this group called the Youth for Equality, which was spanning a variety of higher educational institutions in India to fight against reservations. So that kind of tells you the mindset, and the students in these institutions are disproportionately Savarna. So, you know, that kind of tells you the attitudes which are quite prevalent there. And that echoes with my own experience, although my experience was 20 years ago in IIT Madras.
You know, the irony here of, you know, knowing that so much of the people who are in power of tech in the United States actually came of age during and were in school during these very polarizing times around reservation is actually very critical for people to know, you know, especially for our listeners who are listening from North America. This wasn't just regular protests. This was where campuses were shut down. Students immolated themselves because upset they were that how dare more caste oppressed people get reservation. And so it was really such a deep abiding kind of framework that has just continued even today. And many of these casteist institutions, and IIT Madras is, you know, infamous for the casteism, you know, they become places where, you know, caste capital gets converted into tech capital. And people think that they're having these bootstrap narratives of being autonomous, but in fact, they are very much not acknowledging their generations of wealth that actually allowed them to be in those positions.
Absolutely. The big halo around meritocracy, right? Especially at IIT, I can speak to it personally since I've been there. There is this feeling that the people who came there are like God's gift to humanity, right? There is no understanding of the kind of privileges, generational privileges, like as you correctly put it, right, which brought those students there. It's as though they were just born geniuses who just were destined to go to IIT, right? That's the kind of mindset. And so there's this virulent hatred of affirmative action. The thing with affirmative action reservations is that it in your face tells you that if you're a Savarna person, you are implicated in somebody else's suffering. It really brings that to the fore, and that really shows up. And this is a theme we'll come back to later also with the tech sector too. Well, another example of the casteism in educational institutions in India, which is very important to understand, is the student suicides. You know, I guess the most famous example in the recent years was Rohit Vemula, right? Who was a very good PhD student, and he had his fellowship suspended because of his organizing with the Ambedkar Students Association. And he took the ultimate step of committing suicide. And if you read his suicide note, it's a very moving note. He basically says that birth was his fatal accident, right? That's literally a quote. But that, and that's not the only case. That's just the most famous case, right? There is a very good documentary called The Death of Merit by Anoop Kumar, and it goes through a series of these student suicides in higher educational institutions in India. And Anoop Kumar finds that disproportionately they are caste oppressed students, right? He goes through Balmukhan Bharati, who committed suicide in AIMS, Dr. Jaspreet Singh, who committed suicide in a government medical college in Chandigarh, and a few other examples. And these are the examples covered in the documentary. But when Anoop Kumar was talking about the documentary, he also mentioned that the set of suicides happening in the higher educational institutions, and he found that 80% of them are caste oppressed. So clearly, caste was a big factor that led to it. And it's a major illustration of the kind of casteism which is present in the educational sector in India. I guess a third symbol of casteism, which is actually relevant to the tech sector directly, is food. There is this big hoopla around vegetarian food and its purity, which is actually quite a common cultural thing in the higher education institutions in India. I guess an example of that was recently, like in 2018, IIT Bombay decided to use separate plates for non-vegetarian students, right? They passed a decree. And it met with a lot of protest by anti-caste activists. And I want to read a quote by Anand Teltumbe, right, and describing how it should be understood. And this is literally a quote from his analysis. He says, quote, "This move should be read as a subtle move to revive the caste system in its essential features," unquote. Because he understood really that although it looks at the surface that, you know, you're just trying to separate vegetarian, non-vegetarian for benign reasons, in the context of India, it's clearly about purity, about, as he says, reviving the caste system in its essential features. And it's a big flashpoint. This is not the only instance, right? I mean, again, not far in the past, when the first Modi government instituted the beef ban, there was a major protest in IIT by the Ambedkar Periyar Study Circle, right? They decided to, like, as an act of protest, they decided to get together and eat beef. And they were met with huge amounts of violence by the ABVP, the Akhil Bharatiya Vishwa Parishad students, which is the student wing of the RSS, of the VHP RSS in IIT Madras. And many of them were physically beaten. And the ABVP went ahead and instituted a complaint against the Ambedkar Periyar Study Circle to the IIT Chennai management, and they decided to ban them. So these are recent examples of casteism in the higher education institutions. You know, it's important to understand all of this, like I said before, because this is what leads to the tech sector. This is the supply of students into the tech sector. And they become employees. They come to America, become employees of the tech sector, or stay in India and become employees of the tech sector and go ahead and become managers and so on, right? And so it shouldn't surprise us in the least that they carry the same attitudes into the tech sector. I also want to say that the tech sector in America, at least, because Indians are only a fraction of the total employee count, there is a degree of anonymity that you get, right? So I don't want to make it seem like it's the same as in the IITs. But the same problem exists. It exists in a modified way, but it exists. There's a few things to call out about the tech sector situation in the US. The one thing important to understand, which is somewhat unique to the tech sector, and I guess in American companies, is the so-called politically correct environment, right? There is this PC environment thing where you're not supposed to express your bigotry or any strong opinions really in the open. You're supposed to like really be polite and have a quote-unquote professional attitude towards your coworkers. It's important to understand that. And yet you have at the same time, studies by Equality Labs that do show that a large fraction of Dalit Bahujan employees, I think the number, if I remember right, was 2 in 3 in the tech sector who report discrimination. So the discrimination clearly exists, but you have this kind of thing in a PC environment. So oftentimes it's not going to be like covert, right? People are going, it's going to be a lot more covert. And in fact, one of the main ways in which this carries on is through food. The food politics is one of the ways in which, I mean, the common impression in the tech sector in the US is Indian food equal to vegetarian food. This is extremely common, right? That's not true at all, right? As we all know. And that's really the Brahminical apparatus kind of asserting its cultural hegemony there.
I think in looking at how Castus networks travel from the university into the US, I think it's really important to look at how the hiring and the supervisory processes of tech make it really unique for this kind of creation of hostile Castus workplaces. Because we're seeing, and we've heard this like in one of our other episodes, that the process of internal referrals is actually how dominant caste people are bringing in more of their dominant caste colleagues. And then once you have workplaces that are, you know, more caste homogenous than, say, others that where there wasn't that internal referral process, we are seeing then the need for caste social location becoming such an aggressive way that Dalits and other caste oppressed workers are trying to evade detection because of the overwhelming pressure of creating these like hostile Castus workplaces. And I'm wondering if you can just speak, you know, before we get too into the interpersonal, about that larger process, because not everyone of our listeners is actually in tech. And so I think knowing some of the peculiarities of how supervision and hiring works could help people better understand how it became so Castus.
Absolutely. You were absolutely spot on in what you just observed, Tin Marie. There's no question, right? I think in general, a lot of hiring in tech sector happens through personal contacts. It's like well-known, right? It's one of the most well-known examples of that. It's not even like a secret or something, right? People just say it openly that knowing someone gives you an advantage, right? An internal referral is likely to get a lot more eyeballs than just applying to the website from the outside. Right. And there is no question that caste networks play a big role in this, partly because that's how social networks operate. Right. You tend to know people in a caste homogeneous society like India. You tend to know people from your own caste networks and you tend to use those advantages. And that's how it plays. Right. That's how it plays in the hiring process. There is a promotion process. Right. Where, a lot of intangibles. It's one would like to think that promotions are just based on objective factors like the quality of work that you did and so on. And there is an element of that. Right. The quality of work undoubtedly matters. But that's not the only thing that matters. There are a lot of intangibles around, like is the person a team player? How collegial are they? Are quote unquote easy to get along? Do they hang out with the rest of the team and talk? Do they participate in a variety of morale events and so on? So these kind of intangibles matter a lot. And caste plays in very subtle ways in these dynamics, right? Because you have a workplace where you have a disproportionate number of Savarna Indians. Any caste oppressed person in the same environment is not going to feel at home. So because of that, it plays out in promotion discussions too. So career growth, hiring, all of these scenarios, it plays out. And I guess one other place where it could really play out is if your direct manager happens to be a caste oppressor, happens to be Savarna. If you're a caste oppressed person and your manager happens to be Indian, who is Savarna, yeah, then I guess that's when it really gets bad, right? It could get really bad because then people have a way of quote-unquote outing you or figuring out your caste location based on a variety of signals because that's how they're trained in their home country. Even if they don't out you explicitly, they could show you their caste bias in a variety of subtle ways. So your manager really has a lot of power on you, right? There is no denying that. In fact, we're seeing in the Cisco case, right? That was a case where the manager happened to show it in extreme ways. But you can imagine a lot more subtle variant of that playing out. And that happens. That does undoubtedly happen in the tech sector throughout.
So Raghav, I really hear you about different kinds of issues that come up with respect to caste in these places, especially when, you know, you have a manager or someone who is in a position of superiority over you. I'm also wondering if you can speak to any kind of specific instance of casteism that you have witnessed or you've seen, just for the listeners to get an understanding.
Absolutely. Before doing that, I think one of the things, ways in which casteism plays out in the higher educational sector I talked about was affirmative action, right? The opposition to affirmative action. The same theme is quite common in the tech sector here, right? There's the same kind of belief in pure meritocracy, the idea that people landed in the tech sector, especially in companies like Microsoft, Amazon, Cisco, and so on, where then they just ended up here because they're quote-unquote the best. There is this ahistorical sense of we are the best. And so there's this feeling that people who came through affirmative action in general, right? In America, that's true, whether it's gender-based affirmative action, race-based affirmative action, this point holds across. And of course, caste-based affirmative action too. Although caste-based affirmative action doesn't exist in US companies. But the general attitude towards affirmative action stays. And I think it's important to understand that because that is really the place where you have to come to terms. If you are one of the oppressor side, you have to come to terms with the fact that you are somehow implicated in somebody else's oppression. And I think, to me, affirmative action is very difficult for people to accept for that reason, right? Because that's the first time you're really confronting a system and somebody is telling you that you, as an oppressor, are implicated in somebody else's suffering. And I guess people find that very hard to accept. So you have to understand that, right? So in the tech sector, that attitude is very, very common. The opposition to affirmative action in general. Actually, before I get to specific incidents, I do want to say one other thing. The fact that although affirmative action exists in the tech sector because of the civil rights movement and the things that came after that, it's important to call out that caste is not in that list yet. Caste is, in fact, not even mentioned as type of discrimination that's actually recognized. If you look at the human resource policies of Microsoft, for example, right? They list a variety of discriminations which they recognize in the workplace. And there is like a process you follow. If you experience discrimination, then you can complain about it. And there's some kind of process you can follow. But caste is not on that list. And in fact, this is not just true for, you could say that maybe Microsoft in the US needn't have caste, although that's, as we are seeing, shouldn't be the case. But even if you look at Microsoft in India, where there is no denying, I mean, that is the place, the home of casteism. There is no mention of caste there either. So it's important to call that out while talking about the tech sector environment. Coming to specific examples, one big example that I've seen is, again, around 2006, the Indian government announced additional reservations for the other backward castes. There was a huge discussion in several mailing lists. And I'll give you some specific examples of what was discussed, right? So, for example, somebody was just joking about how loans should also be caste-based and for scheduled caste, i.e. caste-oppressed people, loans should be given at a negative interest rate, right? So that's, you'll see an example mail on that. You'll see another example mail where somebody's saying something like India is announcing a space program and because of reservations and because of affirmative action, you have 20 of them who are scheduled caste and so on. And they go run down the list because that was reservation for other backward castes. They list a few other castes and then they say there's only one astronaut at the end of it. Things like this, right? Things which are openly bigoted. There's no other way to put it. They're defending almost kind of eugenics, eugenic ideas set out in the open, right? With no fear of recrimination. People clearly felt very comfortable saying this in a PC culture, saying this out in the public. I guess it was a sense of entitlement that they thought there would be no consequences to them.
And for our listeners, I just want to emphasize for people. So this wasn't personal discussions. This was company mailing lists where people were openly, you know, debating reservation, that's fine. But they were, when referring to Dalits and Adivasis, they would refer to them as lesser than, they would refer to them as possibly having physical, you know, encumberments for them not being of the same intellectual caliber as dominant caste people. And it just went down from there. It was like jokes and slurs and all sorts of nonsense, which, and, you know, given what Raghav, you just said, if this was a situation of race, there would be no tolerance for this. But the lack of, you know, caste competencies and not having caste as a protected class meant that people were just openly spewing this kind of bigoted rhetoric, and it was horrifying. And you were part of this mailing list, correct?
I was part of the mailing list thread, and I fought back on emails. And, you know, I was called a bunch of names after that. I was basically saying that the rhetoric they were giving is very similar to genocidal rhetoric. But I also got some amount of support as well. But what eventually happened with that mail thread was, you know, some Castor Press employees in Microsoft, and I subsequently became friends with them. They went ahead and lodged a complaint to HR, and HR shut the mail discussion down at least. But there were no consequences for many of the people who were responsible for many of the worst kind of slurs and jokes and other things, other kinds of comments that we looked at. And in fact, some of them, there were no career consequences of any sort, right? They got promoted. And I out of curiosity, I looked at some of these names recently, and some of them got promoted. The others who left Microsoft, if you look at their LinkedIn profiles, they've gone ahead and become vice presidents in other companies and so on. So there's clearly was very little actual consequences that these people had to face, right? They shut down the discussion, but that was the extent of the consequence.
And that just goes to how serious the lack of policy protections are. Because I know that there's been a lot of dominant caste people saying, we don't need caste as a protected category. You know, there's protections under race. And it's not at all clear that that's the case. And in fact, you know, when we have spoken to caste oppressed people around the country, the lack of that category means people are less likely to report. And oftentimes when they do report, the lack of competencies, because there isn't training, means that more often than not, people turn away those cases, don't understand how to address those cases, or they move forward in a way that actually harms the complainant. And this is why this Cisco case really matters, because it stands to create a legal precedent nationally to basically not only open up this conversation, but lead to real structural policy change.
No question. And I like the fact that Cisco case is built on the Civil Rights Act. We got to get the courts, the legal system to recognize caste as a basis for discrimination using the Civil Rights Act. If we did that, then it doesn't matter what Microsoft thinks. It doesn't matter what Cisco thinks. That they'll be forced to comply with the law. And I really like that. That is pivot of the Cisco case, right? And that's like the best way to get them to pay attention to caste discrimination.
Well, and this is also like one point that I really want to focus on, is that however caste gets included within the legal lexicon of, you know, American policy, I think the conversation in the diaspora has already been blown, meaning that many people are talking about caste now. Caste oppressed people are not willing to be silent. And we also have a sizable amount of dominant caste people who are speaking out. And, you know, I think in this context, like, you were one of the people that spoke out on the messaging boards. And I'm wondering for you, like, when you see dominant caste people being silent in instances of caste discrimination, what do you think is going on for them that they don't stand up? Or what do you think is really going on in terms of the psychology of the denial and complicity happening?
Couple of things. I think the one thing, like I said earlier, is when they see things like affirmative action, they get implicated as oppressors. I think that's a very difficult idea for people to accept. Even the well-meaning ones among the Savannah castes, it's a very difficult idea for them to accept. But even if they're open-minded and are willing to make that transition, right, there's very little incentive for them to really speak up, right? Ultimately, they are beneficiaries of the caste system. I think this is the blunt truth. So there are very, very strong effects and very strong incentives for them not to speak up. I also think that the more people should speak up, because I think ultimately it is, even in, you can make a case that although the caste oppressed people are obviously the most oppressed, it does affect the Savarna community as well. Because think of it, the way I think about it is the following, right? There is a variety of extremely hard problems in tech and in the world to solve. I mean, we need to find a cure for cancer, for example, right? And if you really speak up against caste oppression, full stop, the way to understand the fight against caste oppression is you're helping unlock a lot of human potential. Just imagine the flood of talent that would take place if caste oppression ended. You would have a huge number of people unlocking the human potential and helping the world in all kinds of ways. So that would be a reason, and that would benefit all of us. So that's the reason I at least think that it's very important for everyone to speak up against it. To understand the reason why they don't actually speak up, I think it goes to like these social networks and strong like network effects. If you speak up, you will risk being outcast from a variety of these networks. I can tell you from my own social networks, like with my family. And these days, when mailing lists are a thing of the past, right? These days, everything is on social media. You can see a lot more open caste bigotry being displayed there. they do that because there are strong network effects that stop them from speaking out. So, you know, that's how it goes.
So, Raghav, what was your turning point in changing your mind around caste and how people should respond to instances of casteism?
So in my case, I should acknowledge that I was raised to be very conservative on these issues. When I was a kid, I wasn't questioning caste at all. In fact, I remember when the anti-Mandal Commission protests, the first round of reservation issues came up in 1990. I wasn't politically active or anything. I was just in school. But I was sympathetic to the anti-reservation protests. So that's where I was. The turning point really came about in a variety of ways, right? My political transformation happened around 9/11, and it was not related to caste directly. But once my political consciousness started coming that, oh, I need to understand more of the world, there was then this kind of almost a domino effect. And I started questioning everything that I was taught until then. And in terms of specifically on caste, I remember one of the earliest influences was, it's actually around education. There was this probe report co-authored by a variety of people, like John Reyes is one name I remember, which talks about education, the status of education in India. And one of the big pivots when you have to understand education is caste. Second influence, there was a book called Untouchability in Rural India. It had a variety of these stories, right? There was, for example, I still remember there was a story of a kid who, of course, was going to school, but in order to go to school, they had to be well and they had to wear the uniform. So this kid would wear a uniform and go to school. But then when he came back home, if he still wore the uniform, the caste oppressor people in his village would hit him. So there was a story of how he would go into the woods, just before coming back home, he would go into the woods, change his clothes back, right, into the clothes he normally wore in the village. And before going to school in the morning, he would change his clothes into the school uniform, clean himself up. But then on the way back, again in the woods, he would change himself back to the clothes he would normally wear in the village, just so that he wouldn't be ridiculed by the Savarna castes. So that was an example of a story which was very, very powerful. And then, of course, annihilation of castes, right? Ambedkar, and right now, at least my caste positions are heavily influenced by Ambedkar. Those were all the books that helped me transition to being an anti-caste activist.
And it's important, I think, for listeners who, you know, 9/11 was such a big moment, I think, for South Asians because, you know, overnight, you know, we saw Muslims primarily, but also secondarily South Asians as overall being the target of hate crimes. And we also saw laid bare, you know, many of the issues related to American imperialism just brought, like, right forward. And it was like one of those years similar to 2020 where people had a lot of internal reckonings about how were they participating to systems of violence, particularly because they were targeted for the first time by a massive wave of hate crimes and slurs and negative state policies. So I think, Raghav, that is very powerful to know that you know, kind of opened up the possibility for you to then be able to be open to questioning your own caste privileges and reading and coming out of the filter bubble of your Brahminical upbringing to learn Dalit stories and to read Dr. Ambedkar and then begin to challenge your own casteist frameworks. And, you know, again, kind of like digging in a little bit deeper, thinking and reading about Ambedkar is only one step. How do you go then to becoming an active bystander and a conspirator to really stop Brahminical power in the diaspora?
I think, I mean, we've been talking a lot about the oppression, but I think it's also important to remember that in parallel, there's also a history of struggle. And this history is inspiring. Right? Ambedkar follows in a long line of Dalit Bahujan activists who were active against caste oppression. Jyotiba Phule, you mentioned Jay Savitri in the beginning of the show, right? Savitribai Phule. They're all incredibly inspiring figures. And one of the main things that keeps me going, and I think ought to keep everyone else going, is the fact that people like you exist, right? People like you are constantly fighting against this. And that is inspiring. That's an empowering story, right? It's not just this caste oppressed people are this passive victims of this oppressive system. No, they're not. They're actively engaged in these fights every day. The way for us to all get involved in it is to join you, right? Is to join all of you in the fight. In the US, it would mean things like the Cisco case, right? Show your solidarity with it. few years back, there was the California textbooks issue, where again, people like you were very active. The recent CAA and NRC laws in India, which disproportionately affected caste oppressed people, as all of you pointed out. And show your solidarity with these. Once you keep your mind open to it, plenty of opportunities, plenty of ways in which you can get inspired and ways in which you can get plugged into these movements. So I think it's really a mindset, a kind of a change, right? Once you are willing to really join the struggle, the opportunities are all there.
Wonderful. I'm also wondering, Raghav, as someone, again, like in my very first question, someone who's been in tech for many, many years, are there any specific recommendations that you would ask corporations or companies, technology companies in particular, to take into mind when dealing with caste?
I think the first thing we should try is to get legitimacy through the legal system, right? Because the corporations generally are compelled to do things rather than doing things voluntarily. I'm really excited about the potential of the Cisco case, right? If we really manage to win this one and get caste recognized under the Civil Rights Act, then all companies will be forced to do something. But having said that, one should, of course, push what we can inside the companies as they currently stand. And it is true that while companies in general tend to only act when they're compelled by the law, it's also true that some companies have these voluntary impulses. I think Microsoft, for example, this is especially true in the tech sector. Things like same-sex marriage, even before gay marriage was legal in America, if you looked at Microsoft's policies, they did recognize it, right? So if you had a same-sex partner, they could get insurance under Microsoft. If you have a same-sex partner and you adopted a kid, the kid would be covered under Microsoft health insurance. So there were things like this. There were those voluntary impulses undoubtedly existed. And I think they definitely played a positive role, right? So I would say one could similarly go about the caste issue with these companies. And I think the starting point would be to just recognize the legitimacy of caste, right? In the sense that caste discrimination happens in the workplace and caste-based harassment happens in the workplace. Recognize that in the HR policies, right? And then that gives the basis for a variety of processes to kick in. Institute training. Microsoft has these implicit bias trainings also these days, right? In the case of caste, they could extend that training to include caste. So they could kind of embed it into the culture in a variety of ways, and they can embed it into the HR policies. So that gives all employees kind of a recourse to go to respond, to react in case they experience caste-based discrimination in the workplace.
Again, it all starts with adding caste as a protected category. Once caste is added, then there can be trainings around caste competency and how to identify caste discrimination. From there, you can also be able to say, this is, you know, there's zero tolerance policies for, you know, caste discrimination. And that already changes the culture organization, just like you have, this is a zero tolerance place for racial discrimination. So it really starts with that protected category, then the trainings, and then the accountability structures can really be held in a way that's there. But I also feel like, similar to, you know, other diversity and inclusion measures within the tech space, is that we can't just have punitive policies. We need to also have investments in caste oppressed talent, because I think that when we invest in scholarships and internships and coachings, so that we're not just hiring Dalit and caste oppressed employees as general level employees, but that they can actually rise to management and other positions of power in the company, you can only do that with those investments. And I know that other diversity and inclusion measures have really, when they are supported by companies appropriately, we see a sea change in the corporate culture. And I think this is not just like something for your heart or something to have good values. It actually makes really good business sense, because everybody is trying to break into the South Asian market. And when you look at the South Asian market and who the next billion users of the internet are, they are all caste oppressed people. Mm-hmm. And so you want to have programmers, designers, and technologists that can speak to those needs that come from those communities, because they are going to make a better product. They are going to be better problem solvers as we try to identify the challenges of tech for this growing moment in the face of such dire situations. So we really hope that corporations will really take this call. And if they don't, you know, we are here as movements to basically make sure that they follow through on their duty of care towards caste oppressed employees and users. So I just want to thank you, Raga, for joining us today. And it's been really a pleasure to be able to do more of a deep dive around some of the dynamics of caste in tech. And, you know, we want to thank all our listeners also for joining us. And, you know, as always, like if you want to get involved and also learn more about ways that you can support this struggle, please find us at equalitylabs.org. You can also sign our petition, which is being hosted by our colleagues at Color of Change, as well as participate in our upcoming Cast in Tech survey, which is a follow-up to our Cast in the United States report, particularly since we've gotten so many rapid response reports of complaints that we're just going to do a little small addendum to help people better understand what's going on in this space. So, you know, find out about all of that and more by joining our newsletter, by finding us on social media, and we look forward to seeing you here again. So Jay Beam, and thank you, everybody.
Jay Beam, thank you.